From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. Sidney Rittenberg has led an extraordinary life. Between 1944 and 1979, he lived in China. He worked closely with Mao and other leaders of the Communist Party. He was the first American to join the Communist Party of China. Twice, Sidney Rittenberg spent time in solitary confinement for a total of 16 years while he was in China. He now lives on Fox Island near Tacoma. And we're very pleased to have you with us in the studio today. Thank you so much for coming
by. Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
You were a union organizer out of college, as I understand it. And then during World War II, you kind of got in on the tail end, and the Army taught you Chinese, and you love that language. How did that lead you to China?
Well, the idea was the Army needed Chinese language people, and I was picked based on an aptitude test, and in the normal course of things, sent to China to work as an interpreter for the Army.
It was such an amazing time there. Of course, the nationalists after World War II were battling the communists under Mao for supremacy. Mao and the communists came out on top after a bitter, bitter struggle. And in this country, the idea was, oh, we lost China. That was the phrase. We lost China to the communists because of that. Was Mao, and you knew him, implacably anti-U.S. against the United States?
The real fact is that of all foreign countries in the world, the only one that really interested and attracted Mao was the United States. This is confirmed, incidentally, in the book by one of his doctors, The Personal Life of Chairman Mao, where he also records that Mao was interested in America more than any other country.
Did that make you perhaps a bit attractive to him because you were an American and you were in the midst of it?
Right.
He was. Yes. He wanted to find out about America from you.
He did, and he wanted to find out anything and everything about America. He said, just talk to me, you know, about America. Just talk.
You got a chance to spend time with these Chinese communist leaders back in the very early days while they were on their course to victory in the war. What was it like to, what were they like in their free time? What was it like to be around them?
They were fun-loving people. You know, on in Yan'an, on Saturday afternoons, we would watch an American movie that was flown in for the U.S. Army liaison group, and their favorite films were Laurel and Hardy. I used to translate, and you almost didn't need to translate Laurel and Hardy. And they loved dancing. They danced every Saturday night. And part of it was American-style square dancing, which Agnes Smedley had taught them.
So I'm trying to imagine Mao Zedong square dancing, but
yes.
You saw it?
Absolutely.
As you tell it, Mao's efforts to be open and democratic simply didn't work. Why?
Well, I think for two reasons. The main reason was that his concept of democracy, now mind you, he studied Jefferson, Franklin, Rousseau before he'd ever heard of Marx. So he always had this desire to show the world that China was civilized, China was democratic. But his basic concept of democracy was that people had the democratic right to meet together and discuss why his policies were correct. And also to give out ideas on how to implement them better and to criticize people that weren't carrying them out properly, but not to oppose his policy. That wasn't democracy. Mm-hmm. That was counter-revolution.
You call Mao a great man and a great criminal. And at one point along the line, you kind of describe in chilling detail the tradition that he adopted of killing the chickens to teach the monkey a lesson. What did right. that mean, and how was that carried out?
Well, Mao did not believe in Stalin's method of using secret police to surveil people and to haul people off to dungeons or execution. Mao believed in arousing the masses, quote unquote, to watch what was going on and to report it. And particularly in the technology of self-suppression, if you like. For example, you in these great political movements that used to occur every second year, a small number of people would be singled out as pariahs. They would be denounced, everything from their political thinking to their foreign connections to their personal life, everything was made to look terrible. This was the chicken. And at the end, they are punished. They're sent off to the farm or whatever. And the idea was to then turn and say to the monkeys, who were the great majority taking part in these meetings, you see what happens to a chicken. Now, aren't you glad that you're not a chicken? Mm. And don't you want to make sure that you behave yourself in such a way that nobody will suspect you of being a chicken?
Sidney Rittenberg, you really believed that the Chinese Revolution was accomplishing wonderful things for humankind. But at the same time, people you were closely associated with, you saw them subjected to kind of horrible, horrible treatment. How did you kind of reconcile those personal, terrible things happening with believing that this was truly a jump forward?
Well, as these struggles progressed and as I saw these things happening, I gradually began to change, but only very gradually. You know, I began to realize that something was very, very wrong at the core of things. But it took a long time. It was very slow. I think probably there were a number of reasons, but one major reason is that I was living a very privileged life once I got out of prison. Nothing was happening to me that was bad or wrong. And so I think I became insensitive to what was going on in the country as a whole.
My guest is Sidney Rittenberg. He spent decades in China, a member of the Communist Party, close associate of the leaders. He spent a lot of time in jail there, as he just alluded to. He's also the subject of a documentary film called The Revolutionary, screening at the Seattle International Film Festival. You mentioned your being in jail. As you tell it in the film, Stalin labeled you a member of a spy ring. The Chinese obliged him by putting you in jail, and you were in solitary confinement for many, many years. Your wife left you, and when Stalin died, you were released. And I was kind of wondering at that point, and as you tell the story, why didn't this guy get out of there? Why would he want to stay in China after having been subjected to that?
Well, you know, when I was at Stanford studying Chinese, this was 1943-44, I developed this dream of working on a bridge that would bind Chinese and Americans together, because it looked like such a natural, and it still does. Here, we are the country with the most advanced science and the greatest store of capital and technology. What we need is friends abroad. Here are the Chinese who lack what we have and are willing to be friends. So to work on a bridge to bind these two people together seemed to me the best thing that I could possibly do with my life. When I got out of prison and I'm in the clear and accepted, I didn't see any reason why I shouldn't keep doing that.
Well, accepted and also elevated, you tell the story of the great cultural revolution between 1966 and 76, where Mao was trying to overturn the bureaucracy by encouraging the people to rebel against it while swearing their allegiance to him. It was an incredibly interesting time in world history to see this going on within China. And you, through the course of that, became kind of a celebrity, didn't you?
I did. I did indeed.
Why?
And I lived to regret it.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, well, I became a celebrity because here I was, first of all, an American who spoke fluent Chinese and could make speeches and write drafts and so on. And I was also of the generation that had been in Yan'an. Most of this generation were against the Cultural Revolution. So in many ways, I was a find for the rebellious youth to come and speak at their rallies and to advise and encourage them and so on. So it became a real, I was famous all over the country.
Nixon going to China was like a huge deal with U.S.-Chinese relations. You were there at the time. Were you kind of a part of that Nixon arriving there and those talks that no one ever thought would take place?
I was locked away in a little cell.
That's when you were locked up. You weren't able to do that.
Right. So I missed that. Mm-hmm. I read about it in the paper. And actually, they hauled me out of my cell after the first Kissinger visit and asked me if I knew Nixon and what I knew about him and so on.
How did you get by in solitary? That just sounds to me to be an incredibly mind-busting experience to go through, too. And you went through it for years.
Well, it's either mind-busting or mind-making, I think. You either crash or you learn to manage your mind and your emotions. I think I got a big head start because in my school days at Chapel Hill, UNC, I majored in philosophy. We had a great teacher who taught us how to analyze, how to think, how to see what was behind different kinds of propaganda. I didn't always remember what he taught, but in solitary I did. And so, you know, I just made up my mind, I've only got one life to live, and I'm not going to let this ruin my life. I'm going to get through it, and I'm going to learn through this process so that if I do get out, I'll be in shape to do something.
What would you just do day to day? You're alone. You wake up the next day, you're alone. Up the next day, you're alone. What was going on in your head?
I get up, I clean the cell, I wash myself, and then I settle down to study. I had a book at a time. And I thought of the Cistercian monks that used to, or still do probably, sit under a voluntary vow of silence and translate the ancient books and write commentaries. And I thought, if they can do it, why can't I?
You sort of became a monk in your mind.
That's right.
In this cell.
Exactly.
When you returned to the U.S. after the second time you were jailed, you became a business consultant for companies like Intel and Microsoft and Hughes Aircraft, seeking to do business in China. What was that like?
It was like the payoff. You know, it was such fun. It's like big game hunting in a way. Every case is different from every other. And we had to learn, my wife and I, Chinese she is, we had to learn to use our connections in China, gradually learn about business. We don't do business, but we help American companies that we think are play a positive role. We help them to do business. We learned how to do it. We worked with some wonderful people. I found that there are capitalists, which surprised me, that are really great people, very ethical, and who want to do good in the world. As one of our favorite clients, Craig McCaw, put it when we first met him. He said, there's so many ways of making money by doing good that it's silly not to.
What would the young Sidney Rittenberg have thought of the Sidney Rittenberg who is making these connections between these big U.S. businesses and China?
He would not have believed it. He would not have believed it. Generally speaking, you know, I could not have believed in the late 70s, let's say, while I was still in prison, I could not have believed that China would be the China that we see today.
It's almost inconceivable the way that China has changed. It's become a huge economic powerhouse. The way it's materially improved the lives of its citizens is just extraordinary for any nation. What would Mao have thought of that?
Hard to say. He would have been very proud of the enhanced international position. He might be disgusted at the changes in the public spirit, the soul of China, which has sort of been lost in the process of modernity. But I'm sure they'll get it back again. It's hard to say what he would have thought.
That's an interesting statement that maybe the soul has been lost through this push forward. What do you mean by that? What's the soul that you think might be missing now?
Well, what is there for young people today except making money? Maybe some getting in positions of political power, but much less interest in that than in having a great career and making money. I think much more so than our young people here, which is interesting to see.
Does the ideology of money in China kind of eventually supplant the revolutionary ideals of what China had aspired to be?
It has done so.
Yeah.
It has done so. And the leaders who have been terrific in leading the economy have no ideals that they can transmit to the young people. There's no fire that they can light in the youth of China. So far, they've been incapable of doing it, and that's a big deficit.
You know, I've talked to those who suspect that if China is not able to keep the economic engine running so rapidly, is not able to continue to bring people up materially, that they'll begin to think twice about the way that they lack political freedom, et cetera, that the whole thing's going to be tumbling down. Every time the economic numbers go slightly sideways on China, they never go down, at least yet. People are going, oh, there's going to be a big upheaval there. What do you think?
I think that's definitely a possibility. However, they are so good at economic management from way, way back that I don't think that's going to happen. I think they will have soft landings when they need them. They have great resources that we don't have. They have controls that we don't have. I think what's interesting to see, though, we just came back from Beijing last week. What's interesting to see is that the public seems to be increasingly interested in the issue of justice and fair play, so that even in the areas where material life has increased year by year, you still find an increase in public protests and in demands for justice. So man does not live by bread alone.
No. And there are dozens and dozens and dozens of protests in China. This is not really well known, but they tend to take place, it seems to me, at the local, regional level. No one seems to want to be challenging the overall government. They seem to be the lower-level bureaucracies.
That's quite true. That's quite true, Ross. So far, not one of these public demonstrations has been aimed against the central authority. They all called for the center to send people down to deal with the local bad guys. Even this distinguished, blind, self-educated lawyer, Chen Guangcheng, he is not, in the true sense of the word, a dissident. He has never opposed the Communist Party. He has never opposed the central government. What he has done is to oppose failure to carry out Chinese law by the local authorities.
Sidney Rittenberg, it's really been a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much for stopping
by.
Great,
Ross. Thank you.
And I hope you keep listening to the show. I just am your listener. We appreciate that. To find out what we're doing on The Conversation, check out our Facebook page, KUOW's The Conversation. You can also follow us on Twitter. It's KUOW Convo, KUOW CONVO. David Hyde produces our program with Arwen Nix. We get production help from Abby Reinhardt. And Andy Hurst is the engineer. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds.
This is 94.9 KUOW.